Welcome back to Sports Byline, coast to coast, border to border, and around the world on the American Forces Radio Network. It's Tuesday, and in our first hour, this is when we talk sailing with our friend Karen Lyle for SailSportTalk.com. Karen, how are you?
I'm doing great. Just came back from L.A., L.A. Yacht Club opening day ceremonies.
Well, we will get to that for sure, but we have a special guest in studio. It is Paul Kayard, and he's the chairman of the St. Francis Yacht Club. And inductee to the Sailing World Hall of Fame. Help me out. I'm a bit of a neophyte. Where is the Sailing World Hall of Fame, Paul?
Well, it's in Newport, Rhode Island, back east.
Yes, get a little close. Yeah. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
So, actually, that was taken over by the U.S. Sailing Hall of Fame. So I was in the first class of inductees in the U.S. Sailing Hall of Fame in 2011.
I remember my dad went to OCS for the Navy in Newport, Rhode Island, and I remember reading a story back around the Civil War. Was there not a newspaper magnate in New York who couldn't get into the yacht club, so he started his own in Newport? Is that how Newport was born as sort of the sailing capital?
Wow, that's better history than I have. It could be. I mean, really, what Newport was famous, the America's Cup, you know, is the most famous sailing in the sport, trophy in the sport of sailing. And it was won in 1851 in England, and it was brought back to the United States. It was called the Hundred Guinea Cup, and the Americans from the New York Yacht Club, which was in New York City, mm-hmm. renamed it the America's Cup. And they raced for a number of years on Long Island Sound, but somewhere in the, I would say in the early, maybe around the 20s, they moved it to Newport, Rhode Island, because the competitors in there, like Mr. Vanderbilt, they all had very large mansions up in the Newport, Rhode Island, in Newport, Rhode Island. So then from the late 20s all the way through 1983, when Dennis Conner lost the America's Cup for the first time ever after 139 years in the United States, it was raced out of Newport, Rhode Island.
Well, and we just talked to Terry Hutchinson the last couple of weeks about the American Magic Team, and certainly the New York Yacht Club is vying for being able to take that trophy back at this point in time.
Well, as I, you know, through the history of them owning or having possession of the cup for 139 years leading up to 1983 and having challenged for it numerous times since it left the country, New York Yacht Club is really the godfather of the America's Cup.
It is. What do you think of these foiling monohulls that we have, the 75 versus the ones that you were sailing in the America's Cup here in the Bay?
Yeah. So in the Bay in 2013, we had foiling multi-hulls. Mm-hmm. Now they've gone to foiling monohulls. You know, it's just a great display of technology and what you can do with just Mother Nature power rather than, gasoline-powered boats. But the truth is that the faster these boats go, the less tactical and strategic the racing is. And so a lot of us believe that the better boat for the America's Cup was the boats we had in the late 90s and early 2000s, which was an 80-foot monohull, one of which is on San Francisco Bay. You might see it. It goes out regularly. Mm-hmm. That's one of Larry Ellison's older boats. Those boats were heavy displacement, still pretty fast, but they produced a much more strategic and tactical race and one that depended a lot on the crew's performance. The maneuvering with the spinnaker and the complexity of maneuvering those boats demands a lot more of the 16-man crew than the current boats.
You know, and you're a local person like we are here, born and raised in the Bay Area. You represented the United States at the Olympics in Athens. I was wondering, when it comes to Olympic sailing, is that sort of the thing where, like, if you know how to sail, you know how to sail? Or is it like, oh, the Germans do this and the Italians do that, and that's very English the way they did that? I mean, there's different styles for different nations?
It's a little more fluid than that. I would say transient. I mean, Olympic sailing is all done in what we call one design boats. That means that the boats are identical. You're allowed usually to buy your sails from whoever you want to buy the sails. But buying sails doesn't mean you have different size sails. Everybody has exactly the same size sail, the same square footage or meters. But you maybe can change the shape a little bit to suit you. If you're a little heavier or a little lighter, it might be flatter or fuller. But the point of the Olympic sailing is really to find the absolute best sailors, the most talented sailors, and take – it's the antithesis of the America's Cup. America's Cup is a technology competition, a lot like Formula One. Mm-hmm. You have to have a good car driver in the Formula One. But when he gets it in sync with the technical team and they get the suspension right and the horsepower right and the car doesn't break down, he wins. And if it breaks down, he loses, even though he's the best driver. So the Olympic sailing is all about finding that very – the highest talented person. And so as far as country to country, what happens is they train a lot internationally. So they observe each other and they kind of copy whatever's the best technique, and whatever was Australian or British kind of gets assimilated into American and Italian pretty quickly.
Well, speaking of the Olympics, the Star Boat is one of the, your favorite boats, and you're still involved with that. And that was the longest running keel boat that was sailed in the Olympics. I think John F. Kennedy started he was sailing on that 4 years after the Olympics adopted it, and then you were sailing on it.
Yeah, yeah, 1928 to 2012. And, you know, the International Olympic Committee is trying to move towards faster, more exciting boats. It's interesting. In sailing, we dream that someday we're going to be a spectator sport. And, you know, to some extent, the America's Cup, some of the high-profile events are, but we're never going to be football, baseball, or basketball. But they're trying to move to faster, more exciting boats that could captivate the non-sailors' attention. So you've probably seen kite boards out here on the bay, or everybody knows what a windsurfer is. So in the last 20 years, they've evolved away from the slow, just like the America's Cup, they've evolved away from the slower, more tactical boats into the high-speed, you know, very athletic boats, and the Star got the boot in 2012.
Well, now they're, like SailGP, they're above the water now. I mean, They're literally flying on blades.
Yeah. It's I don't know if you've ever heard or seen ice boating, but the concept of ice boating, it's this boat that's on ice skates. So when you reduce the drag, the speed of the boat goes up tremendously, and boat kind of makes its own wind. I won't really try to bore you with the science of it right here, but for example, in 10 knots of wind, those boats regularly do 30 knots of boat speed.
Wow.
So people are like, wait, how could you possibly – it's only blowing 10 knots. How's the thing going three times the wind speed? But they do, and that has a lot to do with the loss of drag.
I noticed in the America's Cup, too, that it's something that we had to grasp a concept of, like, you know, in the World Cup or the Olympics, it's very nationalistic. But you could see Team Italy, Team, New Zealand, Team America, but there seems like there was a Kiwi skipper on every one. Have you ever been tempted to or been asked to race for other countries?
Yeah, I have, and I was probably one of the pioneers in that, not overly proud of the fact from a patriotic standpoint, but in 1992 I skippered the Italian boat in the America's Cup, and I won the Louis Vuitton Cup beating Team New Zealand and a lot of other countries. And then I had to race against America in San Diego, which was the town I was living in at the time and a member of that yacht club. But that's where professional, you know, Michael Schumacher drove the Ferrari car.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of where the line blends between sport and professionalism. And in professional sport, you tend to do whatever's allowed by the rules to have the best advantage to win. That's what the team sponsors want you to do. So probably you just look more to the rule makers. I think it's an unfortunate aspect that Oracle, Larry Ellison's team, had nothing but Australians and Kiwis on the boat. But the rules allowed that, and we talk a lot in our sport about tightening that up. But it's still it's a little bit tighter this next time. But you still can have foreign people on the boat. Mm.
So that's where you got your nickname, Pablo Gallardo.
Actually, they called me Paolo Gagliardini.
Ah, is that right?
It was Italy.
Well, that was
not,
that
Pablo
was...
would be a different country.
Well, that was how it got translated to me on the ferry this morning. Right.
Well, some people from Marin might call me Pablo.
That's right. There we are.
So it's interesting when you think about the fact that a lot of times sports like this and Olympic sports, you're more recognized overseas. So like in Rome, if you walk down to the street, do they go, hey, it's Paolo?
Yeah, that happened a lot, especially right after 92, and it still happens to them. I am better known in Italy than I am in the United States.
It helps that you speak Italian.
I do speak fluent Italian, and you know, back to that situation we were talking about, you know, on a patriotic sense, it was tough for me to, but from a life experience standpoint, it was absolutely a fantastic opportunity. I moved to Italy. Mm. My daughter was born in Italy. I speak fluent Italian. I race on Italian boats still to this day. I give speeches in Italian.
Wow.
I actually commented one America's Cup for, you know, 3 months in Italian. So, In the big scheme of life, and as we know, the events of the last 48 hours make us all look back at our lives and mm-hmm. what we did with our time on the planet, I would have to say it was a very, very good decision to accept that offer, and it grew my life in a huge way.
Well, we want to say grazie for coming in today. We got about 30 seconds, Karen. Any parting shots?
Well, just we're going to keep
Paul
with us for the second half because we had a few things to talk about. So we're going to listen now to the Los Angeles Yacht Club opening day, a little conversation with one of the boats that won the division trophy there.
All right. So, Paul, you can stick around for another segment.
All right.
Great. Lots more questions to come. And if you'd like to call in, it is 800-878-PLAY, 800-878-7529. Rick Tittle, Paul Kyard, Karen Lyle. Come on back.
This is Karen Lyle of Sailsport Talk, and I'm here at the Los Angeles Yacht Club.
This is Doug Jorgensen, and I'm the owner of our J111 Picosa. And we've had this boat for about 4 years and enjoy doing an awful lot of good sailing in California on the boat. And it's enjoy sailing the boat with my son Jack, who is a co-skipper today.
Yeah, so basically every yacht club has an opening day race, or opening day. Most have an opening day race associated with it, and it's kind of a cool kickoff to the racing season, especially here in Southern California. And it's just a good time, and you know, other clubs are involved, and you know, everybody gets to go out sailing in beautiful Southern California. So it's a great deal.
And then also, you had a guest with you today that was on the boat for the very first time.
Yeah, it was pretty fun. I just wanted to go sailing. I was invited by Jack and his dad, and it was pretty fun. Good way to spend a Saturday.
Next, I want to hear a little bit about the weather.
Yeah, it was pretty light most of the day. We had a postponement in the beginning because we didn't actually have enough wind to get going. But then it kind of picked up a bit and it ended up being really nice. The clouds kind of cleared out and sun came out. And, yeah, it was a really nice day. We had a great time. it was a great course. And I thought it suited the boat really well as well. And we were able to get some good boat speed and everything and kind of made a great comeback in the end. And, yeah. Worked out well.
So I was just in Dublin, I'm going to say, and I know you're from Cork, but you're here in Los Angeles right now. Tell us a little bit about your experience today on the water, and then I want to hear a little bit about the rivalry between Cork and Dublin.
No, today was a typical day. I've been sailing with Doug and Jack for about 2 or 3 years on and off now occasionally, and they're a good pair to sail with. It's always a good atmosphere on the boat. We have a good time. We really do, and enjoy ourselves.
Well, you have the 300th anniversary coming up for Cork, and there's going to be a really big party there.
That's
in Cork.
Right. Cork have their 300th birthday, 300th anniversary this summer, yeah. Founded in 1720, and their 300th year is in 2020. So there's a series of events starting very soon through September. There was talk a year or so ago of maybe getting an LAYC entity involved, but never panned out. But there'll be people from all around the world enjoying it. It'd be a good event, good time.
Well, actually, I'm going there, so maybe I can be the LAYC entity. You never know. We can talk about that, right?
A couple of burgees and do some swaps. Exactly. There you go.
Thank you so much. This is Karen Lyle from Sailsport Talk.
All right, thank you for that. Welcome back to the show. Rick Tittle with you coast to coast and around the world on the American Forces Radio Network, 500 outlets, 177 countries. Karen Lyle is still with us from SailsportTalk.com, and our guest today is Paul Kyard, who is in the Sailing World Hall of Fame, and he's done it all. We're going to talk to him about his sailing career from America's Cup to the Olympics. to the Whitbread. I've always been fascinated with the Whitbread. There's something about the challenge of going around the entire world. So what was the, how old were you? Were you like a cabin boy the first time you did it? When was the first time you circumnavigated?
No, I was 97. I was 37 years old. So I got to it a little later than people. You know, I grew up aspiring to go to the Olympics and race in the America's Cup. That was what was big here in the United States. The Whitbread was really more of a European event. Australians and Kiwis raced in it. So I had done three or four America's Cups when I got asked to skipper a boat, and it was a little daunting because I didn't grow up as a cabin boy and I didn't have a ton of sea miles. Mm-hmm. But we confronted that race as we would an America's Cup team or or an Olympic challenge. I brought a lot of my own crew, and we attacked it with the intensity that you would the America's Cup races. And that environment is much more relaxed, and it's, you know, it's about the, not about the voyage, but their mentality is they're not pedal to the metal. So we had some accidents, almost killed a couple people, got it sorted out, and we won the race big because we basically changed the way people competed in that race.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about. Moments of peril, going around the Cape, a potential mutiny. Can you expound on the nearly fatal accident there?
Yeah, I mean, as I was saying, in the America's Cup world, it's like Formula One car racing, okay? You come out of every turn 2 inches from the wall and your foot's on the floor. When you go around the world, it's more like rally car racing. I mean, you have to finish in order to win. If you don't finish, you know. So you can break gear, you can break people. So you have to get in a different mindset. Basically, the mindset is I want to go 97% of full speed 100% of the time. If you're hitting 100% of full speed, that's when things can break. So since it's a 90-day race, you have to come with a different mentality, and I didn't understand that. I was pedal to the metal. So the first bad incident happened about 10 days out of Cape Town. We were between Cape Town and New Zealand in the very southern part, cold, 10 days on freeze-dried food, 10 days on desalinated water. You don't have the minerals. You know, the cruise, it was snowing. It was very cold. Mm-hmm. Icebergs around 2 a.m. And this one crew member who had gone around the world once before said, "Hey, I think we got to reef the sail. You know, it's too windy." And I go, "You pussy, just get back up there and steer the boat." Mm-hmm. And sure enough, you know, a couple minutes later, we wiped the boat out and broke a ton of stuff. And one of the guys was up the mast when that happened.
Wow.
And he was attached, but there were some other incidences. I mean, it's quite a long story, but essentially someone else panicked and cut the halyard that he was on.
Yikes.
And the boat's on its side. And then he was smart enough to have grabbed something else. And the short story is we didn't lose anybody, but it was a eye-opening experience, to say the least. And so from those experiences, I learned that it's 97% 100% of the time. And then the way we attacked leg five from New Zealand around Cape Horn and up into Rio, I had a different mindset, and we won that leg huge. And it really right there we sealed the win, and we won the whole Whitbread around the world race.
Wow.
Tom Blackholler, he was a mentor for you at the St. Francis Yacht Club. And I'd like to know a little bit about your beginning and how the role of a mentor helped you in your life.
Well, Tom was the king of sailing on San Francisco Bay and beyond. He was a two-time Star World champion and an America's Cup skipper, and he was exactly 20 years older than me. And so when I was about 18, he noticed me around the yacht club, and I was crewing on some smaller boats, some dinghies, kind of Olympic-type boats. And anyway, he asked me to sail with him in his Star when I was 18 years old, which was a big in the North American Championship. And anyway, we maintained that relationship. We won some events. And then when I graduated from San Francisco State in 1981, he asked me to do the prepare for the 83 America's Cup in Newport, Rhode Island. And that was my first America's Cup. And I did two America's Cups with Tom and a lot of other things. He grew me in responsibility. The second one, I was in charge of the sailing team. And so, you know, Tom taught me really how to race sailboats. I kind of had natural talent, obviously, through I started sailing on Lake Merritt when I was 8 years old. Hmm. So I won a North American championship in a little one-man pram when I was 15 years old. Wow. So I kind of had talent, but Tom taught me the strategy and the psychology of racing, where to position the boat on the race course, you know, how to work the fleet. And he was a great mind. You know, he was also a race car driver. And he actually died at Sears Point right. doing laps. So
there's a buoy out there in the bay for him.
Yeah, there's a buoy named after him up by Fort Point. So anyway, he was an iconic figure, and I was just fortunate enough to come along at a time where he could pass some of it along to me.
It's very interesting. We're speaking with Paul Kayard. He is the chairman of the St. Francis Yacht Club and a very accomplished sailor. A couple more questions for Paul. It was about 15 years ago or more I was doing this show, and it was during the Vendée World Solo Classic, and there's a sailor from Marin named Bruce Schwab. I don't know if you know Bruce, but he called in once a week on his satellite phone, and it was a very interesting thing for our show. And sometimes he would be having a great day, and sometimes you could tell he had had no sleep, and he was nervous wreck trying to keep his eyes open. What about solo racing like that, and knowing that you can only take about a 20-minute nap at a time? I mean, is that, have you done that?
I haven't done that, and I have a lot of admiration for those guys. That's a whole another type of competition, and a huge amount of mental fortitude. You know, we had those kind of days too. Of course, we had good mm-hmm. days and bad days, but I was with nine other people on the boat, and there's a certain amount of support from the community as you go through those things and the team. But I do know Bruce and a lot of the others who do that type of sailing, and it would be interesting. I haven't spent a lot of time asking guys like that, you know, what drives them to do that. But I personally enjoyed the team element. I like to be on a team. I played basketball in high school. I like teamwork. So, but I admire him.
You know, being the chairman of the St. Francis Yacht Club, now you're in a leadership role. And this is something that has actually been part of your racing. You have been an executive because putting these teams together, oftentimes it's a corporation with major financial responsibilities and leadership responsibilities as well as sailing. What is your vision for the St. Francis Yacht Club in this role? Because I realize there's a lot of other leaders. We have Commodore, and you're the chairman of the board. How do you see that role that you're playing now contributing to the club that helped you start out?
Well, there's quite a distinction at St. Francis Yacht Club between the Commodore and the chairman of the board. The chairman of the board is the CEO of the corporation. So St. Francis Yacht Club has 120 employees and a fairly large, you know, turnover in revenue. It's a big facility. And the Commodore is the leader of the fleet, the leader of the members, the leader of the yachts, the squadron on opening day. We had our vice commodore down at the LA Yacht Club opening mm-hmm. the other day.
I saw him.
Yeah, Bill Dana. So I'm involved in the business side, which is a lot like when I ran Artemis and some other America's Cup teams. And I really enjoy that, actually. That's more up my alley to be into the business. And I'm working. We have a new GM right now this year, and working with him, and we'll eventually have to do a search because he's interim. But I love being involved in the business side.
You know, when people hear things about sailing, they think I could never do it. I don't have the money. And you know, you won the Louis Vuitton Cup and been the Rolex Sailor of the Year. Yeah. Like, oh, this is so high and mighty. But I know that your yacht club, as others in the Bay Area, they've sort of reached out to make opportunities for people that, you know, weren't born and raised in Pack Heights, who actually have the talent, but they don't have the access. And you guys have been very on the forefront of that.
Yes, we do support Treasure Island Sailing Center over on TI, and Carissa Harris runs that over there. And there's a lot of boats that we help provide that are for anybody. Inner city kids go there and have they learn how to swim, they learn how to sail. We also host right at the yacht club all the San Francisco high school sailing teams. So we mm-hmm. regularly see the high school kids running through the club, and they're not members. You know, they're just people that we host, and we support the youth.
I want to ask you this too, because you know, a great baseball scout can see a pitcher warm up in the bullpen and say that guy will be in the big leagues. So can you look as sort of, you know, you said that people saw your talent at 18. Can you look at a 16-year-old amongst 50 other 16-year-olds and you're like, that kid's got it?
Yeah, sure. You can see that, especially if you talk to him. He's thinking strategy already. You know, he's just on a higher level than some. And intensity and focus is a big factor, too. You know, they were talking about Kobe a lot lately and, mm-hmm. you know, his intensity and focus. I mean, that's what a winner has in anything, in business and in sport. So when you see those personal traits combined with obvious talent and a 16-year-old or a 14-year-old, you know they're going to be good.
Well, and you have someone very close to home that's part of your family that's sailing as well, right?
Kinley Fowler, mm-hmm. yeah. So the father of my grandchild is following along in my footsteps. He's done two America's Cups with Oracle.
Mm-hmm. So what would be is, do you have something out there? I mean, it seems like you've done everything. It's like, you know what, before I hang up my whatever it is, captain's hat, is there something that you're like, I still gotta do that?
You know, there really isn't. I think from a pure competitive sense in the big events like the America's Cup around the World Race, I'm a little bit past it, mm-hmm. age wise. So I'm not having hallucinations about going back to that. I still do race a fair amount. I race in the star class, which is, Karen said, is the Olympic class, and that's very physically demanding, and I'm racing against 28-year-olds all the time in that. But, no, I'm satisfied and happy and enjoying life.
One final question for you. I remember when I was in high school and I knew a guy that sailed, and he said, whoever loses the America's Cup, his head will replace where the trophy was. Dennis Connor, for people who don't remember, he was kind of a big star. I mean, he was on Sports Illustrated. And
cover
then,
of Time Magazine.
Yeah. I mean, everybody knew who he was. And to lose it, is he regarded as a pariah or just, hey, man, that's sports?
Yeah, no, that produced the ultimate comeback. So he's the guy who lost in 1983. The trophy was always in the center of the 44th Street, New York City clubhouse in a special room, kind of a rounded room. The trophy was right in the middle. And they said, if that trophy goes out of there, the head of the guy who lost it's going right in that spot. And he lost it. And it was a really rough year and a half for him personally. But he put his mind to it, focus, went out to Hawaii, built 5 boats, trained incessantly, and won the cup back and brought it back to the United States the very next time it was held. So he produced the comeback of all time. And he's known for that.
They sewed his head back on, then.
Yeah.
There you are.
Paul Kayard, thank you so much for coming in and sharing some of your experiences and knowledge with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Karen, once again, bringing in good guests. And thanks for your time. We'll see you next week.
We'll see you, Rick.
All right, we'll take a quick break. I'm Rick Tittle. Come on back on Sports Bottom.